Hi, everybody. Welcome back to No Killing Goblins, your podcast all about the Wandering Inn. I'm Oshi, and this is Dragonus.
Yay.
I think you've infected me with your horrible intro stuff, because I usually don't fuck it up that much.
Yeah, well, I get tongue-tied for it, and actually I realized that I am blaming a long history of telemarketing where I was supposed to, like, yell hello very loudly and greet people off a specific script that would never change. So my instinct is to say the same thing every time I say hello, everybody, but then I also want to change it up because I don't want to say the same thing every week. And then, you know, it's how many breads have you eaten in your lifetime?
I hate myself when I do that. It's like you know what you want to say, but you just tumble over everything and it just makes no sense whatsoever.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I also probably could have afforded to sound more enthusiastic because it's time for one of my favorite parts of the volume coming up soon.
Yeah, but we'll get into it. It's goblins, everybody. Happy day, blah, blah, blah. Fucking goblins. Okay, I'll tell you why I say that later, but I'm a grumpy puss today, so forgive me if I get a little snappy. But let's talk about ourselves a little bit before we dig into it. How are you, Dragonus? How's your week been?
I have been slammed. Well, this specific week has been a bit slow. The entire last month, though, was one of the busiest that I've had at my job in years since I started. Easily the busiest.
Okay, that's usually can either be one of the best moments, like when you feel useful for me. Sorry, I'm making no sense. Let me start. It can either be one of those moments where you feel energized and happy and ready to do stuff and useful, or it can make you want to kill yourself. Because, and I know that's pretty extreme, but that's how it is for me. There's no in-between.
Oh, no. I felt both at once, because on the one hand, it's nice to be able to, like, point towards an exceptionally large number month. But on the other hand, the way my pay gets compensated, I basically made a whole bunch of sales that didn't even count. And then on top of that, since I work with telecom people and telecom companies, everything is awful. Like, picture every awful, miserable conversation you've ever had with Comcast or Spectrum or whoever it is that you're, like, getting your internet or your phone or your whatever from. And then picture having to do that all day, every day, and it's the worst of the worst of them. And it's for people's businesses and livelihoods. So when their internet doesn't show up, they're losing money.
That is, did you, okay, have you heard that Avatar is getting released? Not the Blue Aliens one, the DiMartino's show, The Last Airbender?
I'm very familiar with The Last Airbender.
I heard news that they're cutting the rest of the show and they're just doing, like, a new movie or something on Netflix?
I don't know. The plans to do a third series, like, I am pretty confident that they had vague ideas for a second series with Korra, right?
I think so.
The direction that they went in with it was fairly, well, the premise that it started out with, at least, was fairly obvious to the point where when I ran a Avatar The Last Airbender campaign ages before, like, they had even announced that, I had been riffing on a lot of those same themes about what do you do with, like, all the firebenders left over in the nation, in the Earth Nation stuff, and people that have been living there for 100 years, and all that other complicated stuff that eventually gets turned into Republic City, and then a whole bunch of other things. So it feels really obvious, especially if you look at some of the connecting comics that came out before Korra. They had a plan for at least the first season, and then not much past that. And I don't think they have any idea what they're doing for the third season. They just know it's successful and they want to keep making money, and switching to movies probably works better.
I don't know if they, like, I'm not sure. See, I'm reading things off of weird articles. But all I know is that they were supposed to do an 8-episode with series, with each episode being 1 hour long, which roughly equates to, what, a 16-episode cartoon series? So they're trying to cover the similar amount of space that season one did. And it's going to be a live-action series, and they had, like, a bunch of kids, and I don't know, just... It seemed fairly accurate to the show.
Oh,
I don't know.
You're talking about the live-action Netflix thing. Oh, yeah, I have no clue what that fucking dumpster fire is going to look like. I just reading this. I read somewhere the other day that they were talking about doing a third animated season.
Oh, okay. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about Avatar: The Last Airbender 2022. I think that's what they're actually calling it and labeling it. I don't know where they're going, but they have George Takei in there somehow, and I just hear news, and my childhood may be mildly ruined, but I'm okay with it.
I want to know how the worst possible method of handling the names of franchise material that video games ever invented is now making its way to fucking Netflix.
Because remakes are a thing now, and people want nostalgia.
Pick a better name. Pick some way to differentiate them. Don't stick a date tag at the end of it that you know is never... Anyways, today on Things That Grind My Gears.
Okay, so moving on from vague views about Avatar The Last Airbender, I did want to talk about... not a book, a TV show. Yeah, it's a TV show I like. Have you ever heard of Lower Decks?
It sounds familiar.
So, it's a Star Trek show, and it's called Star Trek Lower Decks.
Lower Decks. Yeah, not a huge fan.
I hate you. So, the Lower Decks show is like, imagine it's for the fans a little bit. A lot of references, a lot of things. And I enjoy it a lot. And they just had their season finale recently. And I liked it. I think it's more Star Trek than almost every live-action show that has come out in the last decade and a half. And I'm going to say it right now. I think Lower Decks is just flat-out better. It gets Star Trek. Other shows do not. And yet, it manages to be funny and irreverent. Even if the plot lines kind of recycle a little bit.
Yeah, I feel the exact opposite way about that than you do. Like, literally, almost word for word.
Okay.
Admittedly, I watched, like, I think most of the first season or the first run of the shit that they put out. And honestly, the feeling that I got from it was that it was one of those lazy... Well, not lazy. I will give it this. It wasn't lazy. But it felt like a less lazy version of those lazy Netflix adult comedies that they've been spawning by the dozens. And tonally felt so weird and out of place and just not what I want from Star Trek.
I thought the same thing after watching like 6 episodes of the first season, and then I caught up with it because why not? I had the time, it changes. It just changes. It's still adult comedy esque, but in a way that stops trying to be about adults and more about Star Trek nerds, and it kind of shaves off the shitty edgy nature, and it just becomes way better. I think, as is tradition for all Star Trek things, the first season always sucks.
I mean, that's not exactly tradition for all Star Trek things.
Name one Star Trek TV show or TV adjacent thing that has not had a bad first season.
Strange New Worlds. You've heard me talk about Strange New Worlds, Oshi. It's the best piece of Star Trek media to come out in forever.
And Strange New Worlds is built on the back of other shows. And the only reason it works is because everybody was already... Okay, I must take a step back.
It is a prequel, and you're right that it does have, like, some big prequel energy coming in. And
forget prequel energy. Everybody... Okay, this is my biggest beef with Star Trek. It's a closet. Somehow everybody is related to the same 10 people. It's a giant galaxy. Fucking figure it out. Maybe everybody does not have to be related to fucking
I mean,
Spock.
that was more Discovery's problem than it was Strange New Worlds, but I get what you mean. Like,
Yeah, but
the point of like Strange New Worlds is that there's a lot of those characters that are people that were on the Enterprise, so of course you're going to have significant overlap, and a lot of people are going to have connecting relationships.
that's the inherent fallacy for me of Strange New Worlds. It's Star Trek, it's very well done Star Trek, but it's also again an attempt to take all of the people that already exist and recycle them. Again, no attempt to create new IP, no attempt to create new characters that it's just not there. And then on the other side, you have Discovery, where it goes just tries to cut Star Trek at the knees and just become something entirely other. Like, I don't.
So one thing about Discovery is I have become increasingly convinced that Star Trek does not take well to arc-based storytelling, at least not like that myth arc heavy style stuff. And what specifically comes to mind to me is oh God, what's his name? The guy who was the he's been the showrunner for a whole bunch of stuff and winds up getting like Brian Fuller, who was brought in for the first season of Discovery and speed ran his getting thrown off of TV shows record by getting thrown out before the first season was even done with production, like pre-production. Some of the ideas that I've heard about doing Discovery as an anthology where every season would be following a different area of Star Trek. Could have been, I think, more interesting than getting three myth arc heavy seasons of like, well, I'm told the third one got really good. And I mean, as good as Strange New Worlds was, Pike probably was really good, and Spock, and I don't know, I'll have to watch it eventually. I'll run out of other stuff to watch. It is on the list to like finish the first season. But oh God, those first six episodes were rough. Anyways, Oshi, I am po calling absolute bullshit that Strange New Worlds is not trying to tell new stories or create new IP. Absolute bullshit for three reasons.
Tell yourself whatever you like.
I have three, I believe, ironclad arguments about why you are wrong.
I'm fine with being wrong, but my opinion is that I don't need to hear your reasons why. I'm fine with my opinion and with your opinion. And no, you cannot use the internet to try to prove me wrong.
Okay, but you've expressed your opinion. I at least want to express mine back then. I'll scream into the void if I have to. Pike's character arc in Strange New Worlds is one of the most compelling things to come out of Star Trek as like an individual character arc ever. The decision to have him find out about his terrible, awful, no good, very bad fate ahead of time, without the context that eventually he does get a happy ending afterwards, the way that like he spends the entire season grappling with it is genuinely and interestingly compelling. It's like watching somebody take that moment to make the quote-unquote heroic sacrifice and then have to live with it for a decade before it actually hits them. The la very last episode of it retelling one of the best original series Star Trek episodes ever made, but with a genuine twist to the nature of that story, while also going ahead and creating a great loop. It was really good. It actually is trying to tell something new, and also take a lot of minor characters and expand them and make interesting things and, oh God, I just completely forgot her name. The helmsman in Strange New Worlds, who was just absolutely fucking awesome. But yeah, I just completely blanked. Just it's gone. I'm never gonna find it again.
The one with the really cool haircut.
Yeah.
Yeah, I forgot her name too. Anyway, point being, Star Trek stuff, cool. What about you? Have you read anything or watched anything lately that impressed you?
I mean, Chainsaw Man continues to be amazing. I'm not really watching much of anything else new. I'm also following Gundam. It's usually what I go to watch immediately after we do the podcast, which means that like I never really have it on the brain to talk about it, but the new Gundam's all right.
Oh, excuse, I'm about to. Speaking of anime, I did watch A Ranking of Kings, with a friend of mine. We watched like 5 or 6 episodes. I have to watch more of it, but I really liked Ranking of Kings. I mean, it was a it surprised me because it was a story, and it didn't exactly follow the exact railroad laid out for all shonen anime, and the main character is deaf and does not speak, which was brilliant because for once, animators could not rely on literally repeating every single action in text. In like with There was actual subtext, is what I'm saying, which pretty much bowled me over.
Yeah, they gave themselves a real challenge there.
Oh, such a challenge, creating subtext in animated works.
Well, no, having the protagonist that they have is the challenge. It's just that then forces them to get competent at subtext and to have to tell a different and more interesting kind of story. It's kind of like how the door. Okay, hold on. Give me a second. I just completely forgot how words work. In my defense, though, I was going to talk about Dororo, which is definitely one of those things that's easy to get tongue-tied on, where the main character is both deaf and mute, and I think also blind at the beginning. And in the remake, it has definitely explored that way more than the original did, when Tezuka was just, being Tezuka on it.
All right. We've done enough anime.
Well,
We
I do
are
have a
done.
book.
That's what I was going to ask. Do you have a
Yeah.
book? Yep.
Well, I was trying to get there. So I had talked the other week about how I had started Naomi Novik's new series, the Scholomant series, which I finished like 2 days later, but have not had a chance to loop around and talk about because I distracted myself remembering the Rhaera Chronicles exist. But now that I've had some time to think about it and go back and reread a few parts of them, this is like one of the best, like, oh, it is one of the best explorations of a lot of incredibly deep fundamental issues that are at the heart of like all philosophical, economic, and political issues and the nature of scarcity wrapped up in a hilariously almost grimdark black comedy that is
Okay,
also not meant to be funny. I can't tell.
first off, it that's a lot to put on what is essentially an anti-magic school story. But sure, yeah, I could see where you're coming from on that. I've read it well enough to know that definitely could be something you take away from it.
Once you look past some of the initial stuff, especially in like the third book where they start really digging into the metaphysics behind why things are like they are. But even the first two books are a really like deep exploration of the nature of scarcity and how that forces people into bad situations and can sometimes compel people to act in ways that when the thing that's scarce is getting to survive until the next day are really dickish, but also eminently understandable. And
Yeah, I just thought it was a new version of apocalypse fiction.
you see, it wasn't meant to be apocalypse fiction, I don't think, because it.
I don't think it was meant to be, but the reason, okay, this is me being cynical here, so take it with a grain of salt. But the reason why it sells so well is because it harkens back to the period of time that's happened in the last 10, 12 years, where YA apocalyptic fiction was so prevalent and so strong, and you were able to package more thematically important, like philosophical questions about who gets to survive, how it happens, what's a society, all these big questions, ideas, and you packaged it in children fighting over limited resources and rights. And that kind of resonated with both left and right, or whatever populist thinking you want to go back, because everyone wants to be a soldier in the fight for their rights. And this is like adjacent to that, because you take that kind of soldier trying to survive thing, you wrap it into a very seminal type of work, because Harry Potter was big for pretty much everybody in their 30s and 20s. We're old enough now to be that our childhoods are now the thing that people talk about when things are happening. So Naomi did a really great job of packaging those same themes in a form that works for us. We're able to see that resonant theme while also going magic school and remembering Harry Potter, remembering the essence of those youthful years, and still seeing powerful questions just like you saw in the books.
Yeah, and okay, I get more what you mean, although with a lot of like what I think of as apocalypse fiction tends to delve more into the moment-to-moment minutiae and survivalism stuff, or then otherwise wants to wallow in goofy grimdark. And with this, I don't know, it stood out to me that in almost every other story I've seen in any genre that has similar themes to this one, it winds up doing, in some way or another, aggressively picking a side. Whereas this story made a real effort to just kind of explore more the way that reality is creating these systems where honestly you have to ask, on a scale of 1 to 10, how bad are these people actually being in comparison to, oh wow, there's awful things that are going to happen to them if they don't do this. Almost every time the character gets self-righteously angry, you know, it's not that long until she stops and thinks about it and takes a deep breath and goes, well, okay, yeah, but I can see how they wound up that way. Like, if Very was interested in actually exploring the different sides of things than just sort of stating vague realities and then picking a side. I don't know. It was very interesting to me. It stood out as like something that was trying to do something different than what a lot of these other young adult stories do.
Okay. Speaking of, oh God, why is my not second starting over here? Well, yeah, okay. So let's move on to another story that tries to do things a little differently and talk about goblins.
It's time.
It's time. Oh, wow. I just hit my nose with that. It's time. We're gonna talk about Volume 3's chapters and storylines that all involve the goblins of the Wandering Inn.
Indeed.
Go ahead.
Oh, and today, we're going to be talking about Rags and her tribe and her visit to Fuckface Mountain.
Yeah, I guess that's where we could start. I actually wanted to start talking about Red Fang 5 and how they were sent off. But
Oh yeah, no, I'm absolutely much more happy to talk about them. I thought we were talking about different goblins today.
no. Well, there's multiple. Well, the thing about this episode, I want to get clear, is that the goblins don't have other. Rax has a couple of chapters, but in general, the goblins in this volume are integrated into the main storyline. And it's very clear from the start that the Red Fang Five are explicitly part of
Well, hold on,
whatever.
hold on, hold on. Red Fang 6, we need to go back. We need to, like, remember, six of them actually survived this.
I'm sorry, I forgot it's six because I can't remember numbers, and I blame Pirate. It's not a spoiler. I just can't remember numbers. So Red Fang 6, my bad. So the Red Fang 6 and the way they were sent off and what was happening and all that shit, this became like a running storyline that passed through the chapters that are connected to Eren. and to the in and to the over, like they don't have their own lettering, right?
No, because they're sharing Torrin's lettering for this chapter and also share their plot with the florist. And every time that I have been talking about my favorite characters coming up, it's the Red Fangs from this section of the story. I'm absolutely just completely, they are my favorite characters. And this particular arc for them just completely blew me out of the water with them and the florist.
I will say, the Siege of Esthelm and the way it was managed, the way Torrin, and we'll talk about what happens with Torrin in another episode, but I mean, we could a little bit here, but yeah, I want to focus in on how Torrin went from sad skeleton to monstrous horde leader. The goblins just arrive at the. They have the worst luck, first off. They literally come when there's like a massive fight between a horde of undead and after the Esthelm has been attacked by goblins, and then there's like. They're all fucked. Like, this is all just a mess.
Oh, yeah, they've been sacked by goblins. They're still recovering. Bodies left unburied will be rising soon. And then Torrin wanders in and just starts making things worse. And in the
Which
middle of all of that, we sort of get this perspective from this character, and she is the florist. And she is cold and lonely and hungry, and there's not a lot to eat. And
she never gets named. Hold on, she never gets named,
she's
does
just the
she?
florist.
She's always been the yeah. So it's one of the most important, I think, early indicators of pirates' skill at writing both horror, redemption, and.
Yeah, the absolute horror of the state that she finds herself in, and the struggle that she has, and the clear desire that she has to maintain a connection to humanity, despite the fact that she is basically getting, a deep unnatural hunger for flesh, and she hates it, and she's so ashamed of it,
And the fascinating
and
thing is that the system reinforces it too, right?
yeah, this is again one of these very interesting chicken and egg things that I find with the system, where there are so many myths and so many legends and so many stories across so many cultures about bad things that happen to you if you do cannibalism. And in this world of magic and myth, I have to wonder, when she ate those people, did she start up some natural process that the system then, started slapping all the stuff onto her for? Or did it do this to her just because she crossed those lines?
Yeah, and the indicators being the different. Okay, so for audiobook listeners, you don't know about this, but the classes were labeled with specific colors. So she was originally a florist, very normal white text cut class, and then when she eats human flesh, she gains like levels in red classes and red skills that indicate that she's like gaining something horrific. And I forget the exact name of the class. Do you remember the
I it was like horror or hungry horror. I just remember it was like one thing that you can note is that anytime you hear the phrase condition in the audiobook, that should be in red.
I think there's literally a wiki article just about the florist, by the way, and I thank God I just googled it. So she gained horror ranks, not even classes, horror
Well, I
ranks.
don't think that they called them horror ranks until books and books later, though.
I could swear it was called a horror rank.
Well, it is called a horror rank, and I guess I would not consider that a large spoiler either way. They're actually something kind of distinct from classism.
It was literally called Carrion Eater Rank 2, derived from Corpse Eater, right? She got Corpse Eater then.
I just don't know if that specific term of art got used here. It doesn't matter. What I do think is interesting though is the way that Her story intersects with the Red Fangs because goblin culture does not have a taboo about cannibalism. And what's interesting is every time we've heard about that beforehand, and it's been mentioned offhand, it's either been from goblins who sort of shrug about it nonchalantly, and or from people that are outside of goblin culture who consider it this act of utter horror. And then we see here from the Red Fangs that at the end of the day, it's just you have to eat, and they're not happy about it, and it does make them feel sad, but it's not something to beat yourself up over or to feel like you've committed a grave sin just to try and survive. And it the fact that her emotional revelation removed her negative condition
Wait, wait,
is
wait, wait,
a
wait, wait, wait. Let's
well, hold on, hold on.
start.
Let me finish my thought, Oshi.
Okay, fine.
Because for her specific character arc through that, I love the way that it takes the. I love the way that it takes an emotionally resonant character moment and system details and level ups and actually uses them to create impact in the story instead of to take impact away or to undercut a climax with this need that some authors have to put level up information everywhere. It's Pirate really using and working the system.
I want to start at the beginning of her arc because that mattered to me. Like, her condition, okay, is the condition of the city of Estel. It's been sacked by the Goblin Lord, by the one that Ryoka might have kind of sort of let free, ends up here, sacks the city, deprives it of defenses. There's a lot of dead people, a lot of starvation. And I want to start at the fact that there's no one coming to help.
Oh,
No
it was
one,
Rags that
no one.
sacked the city the first time.
Oh, actually, you're right.
Because
I could have
it's the
sworn.
Goblin Lord's army that's coming here to sack it this time, and I think it might have been sacked an extra time in between there.
Okay,
They've had
lots
a
of
bad
sacking.
time.
Yeah, lots of sacking going on. Short answer being, nobody's coming to help these people. Nobody sends out, a relief train, nobody sends out friends, nobody comes to defend them, nobody comes to protect them. They're just a bunch of people who get pummeled to death by disaster after disaster after disaster that they had no hand or reason or rhyme for happening other than the fact that they exist and they have resources and somebody else wants them. Or, in the case of Torin and his undead horde, lots of bodies to kill so that Torin can laugh maniacally and enjoy it.
Yeah, Torin has definitely like moved past the pulling wings off of flies stage, and it's not pretty. And it definitely is contributing to this, honestly, this sense of just utter despair that even, I think had she been able to find real food, the florist was still going to be an utterly like depressed, this is a terrible situation. And I have to wonder how much the atmosphere of hopelessness that just blankets the whole city affected her gaining that horror rank.
And then we are at the point where, so we begin at the point where she's just desperate, hungry. She takes these class, she eats human flesh, and the system responds. And I was trying to go through the sequence of events here. The system responds by effectively taking away the levels that we find out in earlier volumes represents the divide between people and not people, is the impression I always get. If you have levels, you're a person. If you don't, you're not a person. That's how that's the essential thing I always get.
Kind of, yeah. The way Kissimver described it when he, or not Kissimver, Kilb described it when he had his big, like, this is what levels are speech, made it
Yeah.
seem like, that you could have your inherent great power, or you could have the power of levels. And a dragon might be a person, but a dragon does not get those levels. And monsters
And I,
definitely don't get those levels.
yeah, and I think the impression I got from that was that because so many people gain levels, it's become something of a dividing line between those who matter, those who are considered people and those who aren't. And goblins create a quandary, which we can talk about later, but let's moving forward from that point. And she loses levels and instead gains this red ranking system that takes away her levels, essentially taking away what I perceived as the physical metaphysical manifestation of her mind, her soul, and the system is like giving her this because this is the choice she made, and it means she's no longer like a leveling person. She's a horror. She's this carrion eater. She's a wordless thing. She's an outcast of humanity. Like, those are conditions that she gains, and it's horrific.
Yeah, and to think about like what we've talked about a bit with the Antinium across these volume, and the conversation we had about like the soldiers not having a voice and how terrible that is, and now she too has had her voice taken away. Is a theme that I definitely feel resonates through this whole chapter.
And then she encounters the Red Fang Six as they arrive at the city. They try to figure out what the hell's going on. They're on this mission to
12 to begin with.
Well, there was, but I think at the very start of their chapter, they have to get into a fight with the undead and lose half their number, right?
No.
Don't they? When did they lose half their number? I remember
So the Red Fangs get picked off mostly just across the whole chapter, or across the whole series of chapters. A few of them die early, but over time, and it's not even just fighting with monsters, they get into a lot of scuffles with other goblins too, because as we're going to talk about with other goblin chapters as well, particularly Rags' stuff, the big goblin theme for this volume is the question of what is it to be a goblin? What is goblin? And we get a lot of different answers and thoughts about this along the way, but in this particular volume, what we get from these Red Fangs is whatever goblin is, it is really not whatever the fuck is going on with these goblins from the Goblin Lord.
Right.
And it's not running, and it's not doing a whole lot of things that, honestly, these goblins, even before they really are getting the full effect of the florist and what she winds up really meaning to them and the bonding moments they have, are actually pretty decent stand-up guys.
I'm gonna keep going with my sequence here. So, the goblins, the Red Fang that arrive at the city, she ends up spending time with them. After she gets to this moment of this pivot moment where she's might just fall into accepting the fact that she's a monster. But Head Scratcher, great good boy that he is, says, I think the quote is, not a monster. And that is probably the most important moment that she experiences in the chapter. But it's also a thesis in my mind for what the Red Fangs represent. They're not monsters. They're warriors. They're people. They have to do terrible things because that's the only way to survive, but none of that has to do with being... None of that makes them a monster. None of that makes you a monster. And the crux of that moment when she works with the Red Fangs to stop Torin's horde, to battle against the Goblin Lord's army and the undead, she leads the Red Fangs into it. She uses her horrific abilities to do all of this, despite the fact that she's supposed to be a monster. She protects, she guards, she makes that choice. And in that moment, when she chooses to work with them, to act, to defend, she is not a monster. And even if she is monstrous to some people. And when she passes away, when she hears that voice, but acknowledges the fact that she recognizes this and removes her terrible hunger, and removes her hard ranks and gives her more ranks in other classes. It's the pirate subtly like creates this. Again, for those who are not audiobook, for those who are audiobook listeners, the label for the restored, for the removal of the condition of hunger is this blue beautiful, like, colored text. And in that moment, you just recognize the whole arc as being as beautiful as it is. Because she begins as a monster because she the world alone in despair. And you see the parallel between her condition and what makes her monstrous. Is the condition monstrous, or is she monstrous? And by the end of her story, you realize the conditions are monstrous. She is not a monster. The person is not the monster. What they're forced to do, what happens to them, these are monstrous things. These are the things that you should judge and prevent from occurring. Not the person. Not the core of that being. And that's how and it's like this really powerful symbolic moment. And I guess that is what made me love the Florist chapters. And despite my ambivalence towards goblins at times, this was an excellent way to create a parallel between who the goblins believe themselves to be. And at the end of it, parallel between who the goblins believe themselves to be and what the world treats them as. And you see it done in such a deft, with a deft hand. And then the goblins bury her. And in that moment, when they're burying her, when they give her a proper burial and give her the, they take on the same mantle that she did. I think that moment formed the survivors of the Red Fang troop that was sent out to find Aaron. More than anything else, that became the foundation of who they are.
Yeah, although, I mean, we see from the very earliest bit of their, when they show up, that goblins outside of just rags are way more complicated and interesting and have a much more involved culture than even we had been led to believe, right? Because when we first, like, see these Red Fang elite warriors completely fucking lost, no clue what's going on, just trying to find Aaron so they can kill her, the debate scene and the way that we see how involved nonverbal communication is for goblins and how they have this really powerful grasp of metaphor. Where, like, yeah, simple acts like picking up and dropping a rock into soup or waving a hand at a specific moment can carry so much meaning. It's something that, like, makes sense. That, yeah, of course goblins would have more culture, but this is not even just, like, oh, they have culture. They have, like, they're... We already knew they were people, but this feels like the, if you haven't gotten it yet, pirate's going to take a chisel and is going to chisel your hard head open and pour in the knowledge that, like, goblins are not just people, but they're, like, real people? God, I've completely lost my fucking words.
I understand what you're trying to say, and I'll let you recover your words. I just, the florist, like, I've forgotten Gunter was the leader. Like, the original group was one hobgoblin and 9, 10, I think, goblins?
Yeah,
it
was like a Grunter, Bad Arrow, Head Scratcher, Bug Ear, Rock Soup, Orange Poo, there were...
Numb Tongue.
Yeah, Numb Tongue, Rabbit Eater, Short Hilt.
Yeah, and then I think that I can't remember any more names.
I don't think that they all got names. It's roughly around the point where they have their longer-term bonding moment with the florist that, like, they all get introduced, and a few of them did wind up dying a bit before that. But it was the sense of honor that I was trying to talk about with that meeting moment, where you can see that the Red Fangs come to this debate that has them say, you know what, we have been sent out wrong. Rags is our chieftain. They're having complex political thoughts about, like, the nature of leadership and chieftainhood. And they're all decent stand-up enough people to go back and tell their chieftain, Garen, hey, you're being a fucker.
I guess we should talk about the Silver Swords and Yavlon's brother, Yalaz, I think? I think that's it. Yalaz. So Yalaz Byers is like the goblins encounter a bunch of people. Let's just say that. First, they're lost, which was hilarious because none of them are trackers, but Garen sent them off to kill Eren, and she's like, do you know the way? We don't know the way. So they get lost, try to go back to the tribe, and then end up in Esthelm. And they just like rescue the Florist girl, try to hide in Esthelm, and then get caught by
She's
Yalaz.
not even the only person they rescue. I remember when they're going in, there's some guy that's attacking a kid, and they just murder that guy and don't even bother hurting the kid,
Of
right?
course,
Like,
yeah, exactly.
unlike the goblins that we met who were just damned and determined to fucking track down and murder Eren and kept invading her inn, they don't even particularly enjoy or relish attacking humans. When given the opportunity, they take a swing and move
And
on.
they just move on. It was like, all I remember is that they weren't described as being very smart, but they were, by their actions, they were a level of honorable too. And yet, what happened was grunt like, what happened at Esthelm was that one by one they all died, essentially, right? They all got killed by each tragic event that occurred. I think there was a moment where the florist girl kind of used her medical knowledge to like splinter and help somebody.
No, it was not exactly a medical knowledge thing. It's just she had long, pointy fingers, and there was somebody who had a whole lot of bugs in their head and
That's
their
right.
ears. So she just chilled
No,
out,
no, no.
cooking the fucking bugs for them. Like it was such a.
I remember she splinted. She made a splint for Grunter's arm after she like.
Oh yeah, that's
Right.
right.
She did that after she saved them from Yalaz. Yalaz was a gold rank, and he was like, "God, I see goblins." I mean, we all know Yalaz.
Oh yeah, Ela was who we get to know through these chapters, and I will probably wind up talking about him more in the Torn section,
We
but
will.
like he's a dumb, stupid good boy.
He's a paladin. And he should be a paladin, and I don't know why he's not. But well, whatever. The point being, she saves him, but like she helps him out, and there's all these little moments that show their humanity in a way, and yet they're hilarious. Even the name Orange Poo is a whole nother thing. It's like,
Goblin names
yeah.
are great and very specific and descriptive and accurate.
And. Whatever the case, then eventually she, the florist, pleads with them. Like she asks them to help her to protect Estelle. And they could have said no. They could have walked
Honestly,
away.
they kind of did. It was there was a lot of we'd love to help, but like, and then she just went out, and then Head Scratcher specifically followed her out, and the rest felt compelled to go out with them.
And it was a public thing, right? It wasn't some hidden thing. She stepped out and died to Torin because this is part of why I'm ambivalent about Torin. I mean, the Goblin Lord's army was attacking Esthelm, and then Torin came in and they kind of made this huge massive mess, and she went out there. And her only reason to go out there was to protect the city. She could have. She's a horror now. She could have just stayed with the goblin. She went out. Brave girl goes out, dies, and acts as a very. What's that? Who's that French girl who got burned at the stake?
Joan of Arc?
Yeah, she does a Joan of Arc.
I don't know if I would exactly put it like that,
It's
but
not.
she does
It's.
she martyrs herself. She absolutely martyrs
That's the
herself.
point I'm making. Like she martyrs herself. Not that there's a one-to-one parallel between their stories.
There's a 1 to 5 parallel between their stories, but it does lead to like th this series of chapters is not without its great fight scenes. But the Red Fangs rushing the Goblin Lord's field command and the fight that follows is without a doubt one of the most dynamic and best fight scenes Pirate had written so far. Like, I don't know why, but for some reason, especially whenever goblin-centric chapters happen like this, I always have this mental image of picturing them as being animated like JoJo fights. JoJo's Bizarre Adventure. Just
Honestly,
something about the way goblins are described makes me think of like Araki's earlier, more muscled-up type protagonists from like the first two arcs
yeah, okay.
before he got all slender and Twinkie.
Absolutely, yeah, that does. I genuinely pictured all of them as these giant muscled dudes.
Oh, sorry. I was able to talk more about this fight scene
Yeah, you could.
because it's dynamic. It goes back and forth between a couple great moments, and the goblin ones specifically are all these great, like heroic riding in over the sunset kind of saves, right? Like you have these shamans and they're dangerous and they're about to like, unleash a necromantic horde, and then boom, bad arrow puts them straight down. But the mental image I have for Grunter just suicide charging and then killing the Goblin Lord's field commander and his giant spider and probably the significant portion of the ground near him, smacking that motherfucker so hard his own hand flies off.
Yeah, I mean the sequence in Esfeld was wonderfully written. The battle scenes worked out, the characterizations of each person, the motivations of everything from the way Torin acted, the way the Goblin Lord's army commander acted, the way the Esfeld's people acted, the way Yelaz and his knight paladin self acted, the way the Red Fangs acted, the way the Florist was developed. The sequence of events, they seem like such disparate pieces, and they come together into this absolutely fantastic moment. And Pirate replicates this to a T at times throughout the series on bigger and bigger scales, using set pieces to move together to create these epic moments.
And just such good use of skills in combat. I never, ever have a skill pop up or get used or like get named and feel like it's getting in the way of the flow.
Yep. Okay. I
And
think we've. Oh, hold on, go ahead.
I would say, and Jeff, I also just one more thing to touch on Ilawis because this is where he interacts with the goblins again. It says a lot about who he is and what he is about when he just says, "Yeah, you know what? I didn't see you guys. Just leave."
Yeah, he recognizes not only what they did for the city, his internal sense of morality will not let him just kill somebody for no reason. You expect that from him because of his original reaction with Grunter and how that happened. But when you see how he acts, that he's able to recognize honor and a level of like earned respect.
Yeah, and also, God, so this is something that's going to come up. It will be re a recurring like point of conversation, especially later on. But honestly, it is hard to fault him when a city that is going to be under siege by the Goblin Lord and has just been sacked by goblins, and then he sees a squad of goblins in the city and assumes they're up to no good. That wasn't him being a bad person. That was him having basic, 1 + 1 = 2. He just didn't know he was doing algebra and there was integers involved. Like, but when he sees the actual shape of what happened and can make the judgment with all of the knowledge, he, acknowledges them as people and lets them leave.
Yeah, and that at least redeems Iolaus for a little bit for me when it comes to his attitude and personality, because as we all know, I'm not a fan of paladins. But
Really? I think that he was absolutely like one of the ideal paladin archetype characters. Like he is the chivalrous knight, like to a T in
I
this.
don't like that. We've talked about this so many. Okay.
Okay, but here's the thing. You may not like it, but some people do, and it was well
I'm
executed.
not denying that it wasn't well executed. I'm saying that despite my ambivalent feelings towards paladins, I thought this was well done and well written and well. It was good. All right, it was good. Let's move on. We gotta end the. We gotta wrap the shit up because we got another episode of Goblins, and we gotta talk about Rags and how the Mountain City Tribe all work.
Yeah, and if this one had some light discussion on what it is to be a goblin, be ready for some really, honestly, some really heavy shit coming up in the
Oh
mountains
yeah,
soon.
it's a the part of the reason why I wanted to focus in on the S-Tome and the. Red Fangs was because that's a whole nother topic. It does build from this, and Pirate does a really good job in Volume 3 of using these chapters and then bringing the goblins back later in the way Rags is represented and the way Rags interacts with everybody and all and using those themes to play against each other. Volume 3 does that a lot.
Yeah, I'm hyped for it.
I will say briefly that I think the legacy that the Red Fangs and the Florist leave behind in Esthelm is important, and I really hope Pirate eventually. I don't know how to like th there's something should come of it. They've planted some seeds, and I want to see where those seeds lead. That's all. That's all I'm saying. I believe that's the only like critique I have about the way the storylines played out because, yes, I understand it's a realistic depiction. Sometimes wonderful things happen and they're just a moment in time and nothing comes of it. But I kind of wish
I
there
mean,
would.
well, let's be honest. The Red Fangs charged in, and a significant number of them died, and they heroically saved the city, and then the Florist got all the credit.
Because it was easier to give credit to the florist, but it's hard to forget what the Red Fangs did.
Yeah, and I don't think anybody ever really does, although that's stuff to talk about in much later chapters.
Okay. Thanks for listening, everybody. We're gonna go and we'll come back with another episode all about the goblins. We might have a guest, depending on if our scheduling works out. So, bye, everybody.
Bye, everybody.
You've been listening to No Killing Goblins.
Edited by Liquid Ender.
The music on No Killing Goblins was composed by System Glitch. They can be found at youtube.com/systemglitch. You can get in touch with us via our Twitter at No Killing Goblin or email us at nokillinggoblins with an S at gmail.com.